Welcome to the B-side. It is Tyler Crawford here with you, as always, with Pastor Steve Croker. Glad to be together again doing the podcast. I don't know why I said it like that, but I'm glad to be sitting down doing the podcast. It's always fun. You know what? The one thing that, as I listen to that intro song every time, there's a little part of me that was just wondering right now, does anybody think that's us?
Singing that song.
Like, because it's not exactly great singing. Like, it could be us. I don't know. I was just like, if you think it's us, it's not. Even as bad as that is, I don't think we're that good. Anyway, it is, May the 19th today. Summer is here. Long weekend is over. Paul is gone.
Sabbatical.
Yeah, not dead, not quit. He's just to clarify. Thank you for clarifying that.
We sent him packing.
It's our first day in the office without Paul, and it's kind of lonely.
Yeah,
it's just even though we're all kind of quiet and do our own thing, it's just one less person in the office.
I already miss him.
Yeah, Paul, if you're listening, you shouldn't be, but we miss you.
And I'm sorry about everything.
Yeah,
please come back to us.
Anyway, so I had a great long weekend. You guys I saw from Instagram really had a great long weekend. Bike rides and yard work. Beautiful, beautiful weather. But you don't listen to the B-side to hear about the weather or our weekends. You have questions about the Bible or what's going on in life and culture and how we balance it. And so we're going to get into that today. We've got a couple of questions. One from a couple of weeks ago's sermon in Acts chapter 2. And then a couple for pertaining to this week's. Acts chapter 4. I thought this week's sermon on Acts chapter 4 was phenomenal. And we'll talk about some of the balances that we need to take as Christians with thinking through the exclusivity of Christ and how we manage that. But before we do that, let's go back to Acts chapter 2. And there's a kind of an interesting phrase, and you notice it if you read it out loud in Acts chapter 2, verse 42, where it talks about the devotion to, I'm just going to read it so that I don't misquote it here. But it says, and they, this is Acts chapter 2, verse 42, and they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship and to the breaking of bread and to the prayers. And there's two kind of phrases in there. I just noticed the second one. We're going to talk about the first one that stands out, the prayers. What is the significance of the prayers? But also there's a article in front of the fellowship. Fellowship, yeah. I didn't notice that before. When we even
and the breaking of bread, well, the apostles' teaching.
Right, yeah. I guess you'd read that.
There's an article in front of each of them.
And it seems to me that it's intentional because fellowship can be plural in the same way like just you went for fellowship. You don't say fellowships with lots of people. We went for prayer. Can mean multiple words. So it seems to be an intentional, by Luke, an intentional classifying. So what's the significance of that? Or is it?
So if you have a more literal translation, it'll say the fellowship to the breaking of bread and the prayers. I think some other translations will smooth it out in English. To and they've devoted themselves to prayer or something like that. Maybe. I haven't surveyed all the translations, but I think that some do that. ESV is a little bit more, tries to be a little bit more literal. One of the challenges is the nature of the Greek language and the way the article works, that sometimes we don't translate it because they put the article in front of things, the definite article, so we're the indefinite article is the word in English. Little grammar lesson there. But they get used differently in Greek and English. So sometimes there's a definite article in front of a word that we don't translate. It doesn't make any sense. That's not the way it works in English. It's just the nature of translation. You always, there's, you know, things you have to.
There's no such thing as word for word.
It's impossible,
it's,
yeah.
It's, yeah, it's always going to be the best word that describes this one.
So sometimes the definite article. The definite article in English usually is used for to mean very specific things. The prayers thinks of very specific prayers, but sometimes that's how it works in Greek. But other times it can be for emphasis, or it can be to identify its role in a sentence as far as this is the noun or this is the subject and things like that. So it works a little bit differently. So what does it mean, the prayers? It could be, it's likely, refers to there is a set prayers in Jewish faith at this time that were prayed. So in our passage this week, in chapter 3 and 4, Peter and John go up to the temple at the hour of prayer, specifically the 3 o'clock prayer time. There's three times of prayer when the Jewish people, faithful Jews, would go to the temple to pray. There were set prayers that were prayed at that time. The Shema from Deuteronomy 6:4, Lord our God, Lord is one, and other prayers as well were prayed at certain times. So there's a kind of a set communal prayers that were prayed together as God's people at certain times. So it could be referring to that, that the early church at this point, exclusively made up of Jewish people, continued to pray the prayers. They were committed to praying the prayers. And we see in the very next chapter, a couple verses later, Peter and John going up to the temple at the time of prayer.
Now they were clearly going up there to participate in prayer.
Yeah, so the Jewish Christians were both faithful Jews and faithful Christians. It's not till later when the gospel goes forth to Samaritans and then Gentiles, which hasn't happened yet, that you see the challenges of what does it mean now to be a Christian and not a Jew, and where you see the Christian church not identifying with the synagogue anymore or the temple, but being independent of those. And that takes time. And eventually, more and more Gentiles come to faith in Christ, and the churches take on a very Gentile flavor. And there's sort of an identity crisis a little bit. What does it mean to be Christian and not Jewish? So, but at this time, it could mean that the prayers refers to the set of Jewish prayers. At the same time, we could also say they're devoted to prayer.
Right.
Not set Jewish communal prayers, but we see them praying constantly through, you know, in not this week's passage, which continues the trial, but the next one, it's all the believers joined together praying for boldness, praying together. So and as it goes, we frequently see them gathering for prayer, devoted to prayers of different kind. We also see in this section, it was the same sermon that Paul did, they are breaking bread in their homes, receiving their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God. You have to imagine that's in their home. So they gathered in the temple daily, and they gathered in their homes, and they're receiving their food with generous hearts, glad and generous hearts, praising God. You would imagine, I'd be surprised if they weren't at that time also praying together. Whether it's just with the glad and generous hearts, they're praying for thankfulness for their food, or whether they're praying for gospel advancement, praying for each other, praying for the sick, whatever it is. So they're committed to prayer in general.
Right.
But it may mean that the prayers means they were still devoted to praying the regular, faithful Jewish prayers to God. Or it could mean that the article is just being emphatic, and it just means prayers. So it's a little bit ambiguous, but if there are specific prayers in mind, it would be those.
Fair enough. Another question that we got this week, and I think it's actually helpful because I think about it as somebody who teaches to students a lot, who might not have the same kind of history of the Bible and reading stories and understanding some of the colloquial or Christianese language that we kind of sometimes use to describe things in the church, and the words that we are often really familiar with and understand often what they mean. But one that came in that I thought was helpful, and I was like, in my head, I probably have always grouped these four together. But we talk and we hear them throughout the New Testament, most of them, especially in the book of Acts. The Sadducees, describing groups of people, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, and the Essenes. Is that fair to kind of group them together, or who were they? Did they were were they all together and killing Jesus? Like, we, right. you know, the Pharisees, obviously the one we understand the most. Can you kind of pick that yeah. cobweb or
sure.
ball of wires apart?
So we meet the Sadducees here in Acts 4. They're kind of leading the charge on this. And we talked about it on Sunday. The Pharisees and the Sadducees are in the public eye. The Zealots and the Essenes are outsiders. But these are the four major groups, spiritual groups, religious groups in the first century. So let's go Zealots. The Zealots were the guys who refused to pay taxes. Their answer was war.
Their answer to the Roman...
To the Roman occupation.
So all these people would be Jewish.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And so these Jews, the Zealots, are the guys who hid up in the hills, gathered little militia, and attacked Rome. And refused to pay taxes, refused to cooperate. They fought Rome. Like, you don't play nice with these guys. They're idolaters. They're evil. We don't, you know. So that was sort of there. So they don't, they're not that present in public life. They're hiding in the hills to little attack a garrison or something like that, right? The Essenes also were kind of hiding in the hills, but in a different way. The Essenes, who aren't actually mentioned in the New Testament, but are mentioned in other first century documents, including the Qumran community, was an Essene community. And they're sort of ascetics in that sense of like depriving themselves. Ascetic, mm-hmm. not aesthetic, but ascetics. A-S-C-E-T-I-C-S. They're kind of like monks, but monks aren't a thing for a couple hundred more years.
Right.
But they were just trying to live a pure spiritual life, separated from the big bad culture and the Roman occupation. And so their answer to things was a morally pure community, separated from the culture. So that's what's going on. Some people suspect that maybe John the Baptist was an Essene or had an Essene background because it's sort of familiar, you know, out in the desert, living in this community. Okay, so then the Pharisees and Sadducees. The Pharisees are connected not to the temple, but to the synagogues.
Okay.
So they are they're the conservatives, theologically, the faithful ones. Through some of the intertestamental period, they never sold out. They were the faithful guys. They're the good guys in many cases. Like, we would go, out of all these groups, they're probably the ones that, as evangelicals, we would go, yeah, that's our team. Because they're the Bible guys, they were the conservatives, they were the guys who stayed faithful through some of the days when other groups were selling out to the occupying powers of the time or whatever. They are connected with the synagogue. So in every town, as Jews spread out and got further from the temple, whether it's through, you know, there was Jewish communities in almost every major city in the Roman world, whether it's through being scattered by the Roman powers or whether just through natural ways they spread out. And there's a synagogue in most every town where they would meet on Sabbath for teaching and prayer. And the synagogue was sort of the place of power for the Pharisees. They were Bible teachers, conservative guys, whose primary motive was we need to keep the law. In fact, the reason why we got sent into exile was breaking the law, and we can't let that happen again. And the only way the Messiah is going to come is if we keep the law and purify. And in fact, we're so concerned about keeping the law that we're actually going to make some new laws to help, you know, we're putting fences around the fences around the fences to make sure that we don't break the laws. We don't even break the laws that protect us from breaking the laws, right?
Yeah.
So we count that as super legalistic, but I think they had good intention. How do we help people keep the rules and not become idolaters again that got us kicked into exile? They were opponents of Jesus because he broke their rules. They didn't have a lot of power, but they were popular with the people. The people admired them for their moral purity. It was sort of an outer moral purity, but, you know, they had high popular opinion. They associated with the people, and they were all over the place. So they're present in Galilee where Jesus is.
And often their intentions were good,
yeah,
you might call, or pure.
And in fact, we learn throughout in both the Gospels and Acts that there's actually a number of Pharisees who have come to faith in Jesus Christ.
Right, Zacchaeus, right? Was he? Oh no, he was a tax collector.
Nicodemus is a Pharisee, and it sounds like he does. And there's others in Acts, and we're told of certain points where a number of the Pharisee party have become Christians as well. Now the Sadducees are centered in Jerusalem. There's not nearly as many of them. They sold out to Rome And they're sort of the aristocratic party who holds all the power. And they're centered around the temple and have authority in the temple. So there aren't Sadducees up in Galilee where
so the Jesus Pharisees, is raised. The Pharisees are centered around the synagogue.
Synagogues, yeah.
And the Sadducees around the temple. So the temple's in Jerusalem. The synagogues are the local... Everywhere.
Yeah, all over the place. Every little town's got a synagogue.
All right. It's good.
Most every town. Even outside of Israel. There's a synagogue, you know. There'll be a synagogue in a lot of places. Because there's a Jewish community in say, Ephesus or Corinth or whatever, right? And the Sadducees were the sellouts. They're the sort of the liberals. They denied the authority of much of the Old Testament, only held to the Pentateuch. They denied the resurrection. They denied a lot of the miracles and spiritual things. They're just sort of rationalists and skeptics who sold out to Rome and got power in the temple and power over the people. And together, the Pharisees and Sadducees made up the Sanhedrin, which is sort of this ruling Supreme Court, high authority over all the Jewish people, who... So it's I can't remember the numbers, but it's made up of both Sadducees and Pharisees.
So they had the Sanhedrin. Agreed. So they never probably decided on anything together.
They were bitter enemies.
Yeah.
They disagreed about everything. Like the Pharisees viewed the Sadducees as heretics, really, and the Sadducees sort of viewed the Pharisees as rednecks. Yeah. Sort of like the fundamentalists, right? Like they, and they're the nobodies. They're not the important aristocratic people like us, the wealthy. They're commoners.
Yeah, they would have agreed. It was the Sanhedrin that agreed to have Jesus sent to the officials.
The question was, you know, which one was responsible? Well, the Pharisees opposed Jesus from the beginning in Galilee, but Jesus only encountered the Sadducees when he came down to Jerusalem, which is really only for festivals. There's a few stories where he comes down to Jerusalem and he butts heads with the Sadducees, clears the temple and things like that, and people, you know, so he runs into the Sadducees. They come and ask him just before the week of his death about, they ask the question about the resurrection, which is really ironic because they don't believe in it, but they're trying to trap him. But so he butts head with both, more the Pharisees, because that's who's hanging out in Galilee, but it's together the Sanhedrin, Pharisees and Sadducees. It's like the only thing they ever agreed on was we all agreed we need to kill Jesus. So both parties were against Jesus, and here, though this group is mostly Sadducees, there's certainly Pharisees among the rulers, and they agree as well that we need to get rid of the apostles and this early Christian teaching.
Interesting. So, I mean, in reality, they're not interchangeable names.
No.
They're all very different.
Very different. Yeah, we kind of...
And they all kind of, like, you can easily make kind of connection points to,
and they,
oh, this is who this group would be today in the evangelical church, if you want to.
And they all would disagree.
We won't get into it so we don't offend anyone in case we...
Yeah, they disagree with Jesus and the apostles, but sometimes for opposite reasons. Like, the Pharisees would have viewed Jesus and the apostles as sort of loose, morally loose, right? They're eating food on the Sabbath. Or they're plucking the heads of grain on the Sabbath. They're working on the Sabbath. They're breaking the Sabbath. Therefore, you know, that this is not good. He healed someone on the Sabbath. That's work, you know. And in their minds, Jesus is sort of, he's breaking the law. Or he's breaking their traditions. And the Sadducees would have been motivated by hundreds or thousands of people are following this nobody who didn't go to our schools, he didn't get trained properly. Who is this guy that it's just like jealousy and a power play? Fear that we're going to lose our place. And if there's an uprising that Rome has to put out, maybe the Sadducees get put out of power. You know, so they're about protecting their turf. That's all they care about. The Pharisees care about moral purity in their opinion, but it's misguided.
Well, and the Zealots would have not liked the fact that he wasn't...
He said pay taxes to Caesar.
Yeah.
Like, there's times when the Zealots wouldn't have appreciated that. And the Essenes nobody hears of because they're out in the desert hanging out by themselves. What's ironic, what's interesting then is, like, in Jesus, among Jesus' disciples, when you list them out, you got a guy named Simon the Zealot, and you have Matthew the tax collector. And you're going, this is a weird group.
Yeah.
Those guys normally would be at each other's necks. Tax collector's an absolute sellout who will sell his morals for make for an income. And a zealot says,
work for Rome. We don't even pay taxes to Rome. So, I mean, it's an interesting group.
Anyway, thank you for clarifying that. That's good. So, finally, as we kind of wrap up podcast for today, Acts chapter 4 talked extensively about the exclusivity of Christ and Peter kind of defending his actions based on Jesus. So, transferring or kind of thinking about how, as Christians, we do that, how can we stand up as Christians for the exclusivity of Christ in a culture built on tolerance? Because saying Jesus is the only way is a great way to be ostracized, to be ignored. So as we think about conversations with our neighbors and our friends and people we work with, how do we stand on both those legs, or can we?
Okay, can we make the gospel not sound intolerant? No.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the end, can we share Jesus in a way that doesn't sound offensively exclusive? In the end, we can't. Oh, without losing the gospel somehow. So, in one sense, we just have to not be afraid to do that, to make exclusive claims. Now, that being said, we need to be gracious people, love our neighbors, be generous, kind, hospitable. So we're not talking about walking up and down the streets with like picket signs, Jesus is the only way, that type of, obviously that's not what anybody's after. But when we do say, I believe that the only way to God is through what Jesus has done, I think he's the only Savior. And I think you should believe in him as well. And to consider the claims of Jesus, that's always said in the context of relationship, love, generosity, hospitality, welcome, kindness. So just because that message sounds intolerant doesn't mean that we should be intolerant people. I mean, like, tolerance, we've talked about this before, but like the old definition of tolerance is something I think we ought to all seek out to be, which is, we disagree, but I'm still able to treat you like
a brother,
a human being, like that you are worthy of respect and honor and kindness, and you have value as a person, even though we don't agree. I tolerate your view. I don't agree with you, but that my disagreement with you will not affect the way I treat you. Yeah. That's not what people mean by it anymore.
No, it means acceptance now.
You affirm my belief.
Yeah, you have to affirm me,
that old view of tolerance is exactly what we should be. Right.
Well, we're not a culture anymore that, you know, the old agree to disagree kind of phrase, like, we're not a culture that's okay with that, right? Like, so as Christians, we almost have to understand that, like, you know, you watch the news for any length of time and you recognize we're not seen in a light that's generally positive as evangelicals in the media, in the mainstream. And I mean, part of it is where we are in Canada. I think we've got two strikes against us in that we're, as Canadians, exceedingly polite. So there's even like, though most of our news and a lot of that kind of stuff kind of flows from the United States, that they don't share that same kind of box with us where, you know, think about like, I find myself doing this all the time. I bump into someone on the street or someone bumps into me on the street. I apologize to them. And then I'll say, I'm sorry. And then I walk away going, I'm not sorry, I didn't do anything wrong. Like, I have to, like, catch myself, right? So we have that going for us, plus this desire to be tolerant. And I think we've really lost touch of what, like you said, like, what tolerance looks like and what it means. And so, I think for me, as I thought about it and listened to your sermon on Sunday, was, I think actually gospel-loving thinking is not being satisfied, not being okay. Like we're taught to, we need to be okay that we all have different beliefs. And I was thinking about it on Sunday, going, I'm not okay with the fact that this person in my life doesn't know Jesus. That I'm not satisfied with that.
Yeah.
And so I want to do everything I can to not just accept that. So how do we do it? Right? Like it's tricky.
Someone shared this with me and I liked it. It was after the message, so I didn't really incorporate this. I should have. But the idea that it's not so much that we can think about it as Jesus is the only way, as in God hasn't made six ways available to us, but only one, and so there's this exclusive way. And that's true. That is true. But another way to think about it, kind of shift it a little bit, is he's the only one coming for us. We're lost and broken. How many saviors are coming to get us, to rescue us? There's only one. Only, it's not that God is kind of rudely only made one path, and these guys are arrogant for thinking that. It's better to think about it as how many saviors is God going to send to come rescue us? And there's only Jesus. Okay. Jesus is the only one. He's the shepherd that comes after the lost sheep, and he's the only one that's coming for the lost sheep. So don't look for someone else to come. Receive the one who has come for you, because no one else is coming for you. And it's motivated not by a narrowness, but it's motivated by love, that he's the way to the Father. And in love, he made a way. In love, there is a Savior, and he's coming for us. And to turn down his loving approach, rescue, looking for something else, would be foolish.
Yeah, I mean, I was just laughing as you were saying that, thinking in my head, going, if you're floating on a life raft in the middle of the ocean, when the helicopter shows up and drops his ladder, you're not lamenting the fact that there's not a boat for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like, or a scuba diver.
I want options.
Or a submarine. Like, I want options. I want to be able to choose which way I go. No, you're going, like, I'm desperate need of help. I will take whatever help I get. If a dolphin shows up and says they want to swim me back to land on their fin, I'm going to do it. That's the one way to get saved. And as opposed to, I want a God who gives me options. And see, I can pick the fruit from the different trees.
As we talked about on Sunday, I think that's where the issue... I found it helpful is one of the issues is like this, for most people in our culture, the question of faith is a question of preference and perspective. That, you know, it's not about truth. It's not about history. It's not about facts. It's about, I like blue, you like red. My preferences are this, your preferences are that. I like Jesus. I like yoga. I like this. I like that, whatever it may be. And we each have our own preferences. In which case, Christians are kind of bigoted that they're saying you're demanding that everyone adheres to their preference. But what if Christian faith is not part of preference and perspective, but is actually a matter of fact and history? Then it's no longer about tolerance and intolerance. It's actually about truth. So we're looking at this as Jesus rose from the grave, and I'm 100% sure of it. And his claims to be Messiah and Savior, rescuer that God has sent, are true. And we're lost and broken, and he's the only Savior.
Yeah.
I view those as facts of history. Other people see my religious faith and think that's just his preference. And how could he possibly demand that we all hold his preference? So what is Christian faith? Is it preference, style, or is it about facts and history and truth? And that's where there's obviously going to be significant disagreement on what the nature of Christian belief is.
It's fascinating. When you really break it down, I think at all this, and it comes back to what I think we've talked about, is this desire, culturally, at least in North America, to, it's probably a human condition, to just make up for ourselves what, like, we don't like someone telling us what truth is. And I think that's why, like, Acts 1 through 12 is a bit disconcerting, or maybe even a bit uncomfortable, because here, like, you can't, like, of course you had to preach a great sermon on the exclusivity of Christ on Sunday, because the text wouldn't allow for anything else.
Yeah.
Like, how could you preach that text with any other end game, right? And it can leave you a bit uncomfortable because I think part of the way we're wired in our sinful nature from the fall is that we want to decide for ourselves. We want to be our own God and decide who he is and how he responds and how he might call us to himself. And it can...
The only thing I'd add is that this feels like a new situation for us, but it's not.
Hmm.
This was what the early church faced for the first few hundred years. They were the outcasts. They were intolerant in the sense that they refused to worship the Roman gods. Like Christians in the empire, Roman Empire, there was constant pressure on them to participate in the Roman imperial cult, to make sacrifices to Roman gods, to declare their allegiance to Caesar and to the Roman authorities. There was gods for each trade guild, gods for this, gods for that. So, in fact, you'd be often out of work if you didn't. So there was constant pressure, and they were viewed as the atheists because they didn't affirm all the pantheon of Roman gods and goddesses. And so they faced this same pressure of being of an accusation of intolerance, and they stood strong, and the gospel exploded.
Right.
From 120 to 3,000 to 5,000 to actually being a majority faith in the Roman world by the year like 300 before Constantine. And that came from them being faithful and suffering for it.
Well, I think that's the reality. The more you look at the text, the more you go, you know, like I read a text this morning and I went, that sounds really familiar. And it's this cyclical, like, we're, every generation is dealing with it. Like, 2 Timothy chapter 3. But understand this, that in the last day, there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeased, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. It goes on. Like, does that not sound exactly like the culture we live in now? And this was Paul writing to Timothy in the first century. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's not a new thing. Anyway, that's all we've got for today. Lots of good discussion. If you have questions on this stuff or anything else, please do send it to our new email address. You can send it to the old one, but it'll be gone soon. But bside@tachurch.ca. We would love to get a good group of questions together, and we'll carry this B-side on probably for a few more weeks at least, but would love to get some more questions on Acts or anything else that's going on in your life. Feel free. But thanks for checking us out.